Welcome, everyone, to You're Gonna Need a Bigger Bottle.
Welcome!
Scott didn't do his normal... Oh, there it is. He's fucking late on his welcome!
Well, there's lag. We're back in the Zoom bunker, all right? There's latency. There's lag. Shut up.
Anyway, it's a podcast about movies and wine.
It's a podcast about movies and... I'm arguing with you, and I shouldn't be. It is a podcast about movies and wine.
It is a podcast about movies and wine. And for those of you out there who don't know shit about one or both of these topics, my name is Jamie. I'm the wine guy.
I'm Scott. I'm the movie guy. And we, Jamie and I, are here to help you. Each episode, we pair a movie that I love with a wine that he loves.
We'll tell you and each other why we like them, how they're made, and why they work. Hopefully, we find a pairing that works. Sometimes we don't.
Oftentimes, we don't. Oftentimes, recently, we have been very verbose in our recordings, and last time we talked about 2004's rom-zom-com from director Edgar Wright, Shaun of the Dead. We had a great and very lengthy conversation about it, and now here is the conclusion.
The conclusion, focusing on the Leume Grüneveltliner from the Kamptal in Austria.
We will now turn it over to Past Scott and Past Jamie for their conversation, already in progress.
Dankeschön.
But so, Jamie, occasionally on the show, we also talk about wine.
Every now and then, we talk about fermented grape juice.
Du-tomp. So, tell me, Jamie, when I told you that
your
we were going to...
French is so good.
And my accent is very convincing.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes. So, for this movie, I paired the 2019 Leume Grüneveltliner from Kamptal, Austria. From the village of Langenlois.
I see. Your German accent's pretty good.
Right?
Yeah.
Pretty good.
Yeah. Just last night, Jamie said, Mein Führer on an Instagram comment. so I think we're, I don't know.
Mein Führer!
We might be trending, y'all.
this wine is available at wine.com for $27 plus shipping. I have loved this wine for a long time. I know I say that a lot. I've been picking wines that I have longstanding familiarity with, because they have stood the test of time for me, generally speaking. This wine was on the list back at Tashan. This was introduced to me by Dave Costanzo, friend of the pod.
Is he a friend of the pod?
He's a friend of mine. You know him, right?
I have met him. Dave a few times.
He's a close enough friend of mine that I feel comfortable calling him a friend of the pod.
Does he listen to the show?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, he does.
Well, he should write us a review then.
He really should. Dave, please write us a review.
Yeah, come on. Come on, Dave. Come on.
Anyway, the wine for me is indicative of like everything that's great about Grüneveltliner from Austria. The Kamptal is one of several appellations in the Danube River Valley. It is named after the Kamp River, which is a tributary to the Danube. Fun fact, Tal, as a suffix, just means valley. Kamptal, the Kamp Valley.
Is that a fun fact?
I find it to be fun.
Okay. I don't even know if it's a, I mean, I guess it's a fact.
It's a fact.
Because it's true.
It's true, yes.
I mean, I don't know that it's true. You just said it.
Anyway, Leume has been a leader in the industry since he took over his family's winery in 1997 and subsequently built a black cube in the middle of the Austrian agricultural farmland, a literal black cube over top of an old hand dug wine cellar. Bizarre shit.
Like a building?
Yeah.
The building is a black cube.
Correct.
All right. I'm going to look this up while you're talking.
Yeah. Just look up Leume Winery and it'll be one of the first image results. He founded Respect Biodyne, which is a certifying body for biodynamic agriculture in Austria. I think his wines are a benchmark and super delicious. This is the entry-level stainless steel fermented, easier-going bottling. He also does a bunch of oak-aged single vineyard wines that are fantastic, and they are labeled Mit Achtung, which means with respect.
Mm. We'll have to share this on the social media with everyone listening along at home. We do need to offer an important correction. It is not a black cube. It is a black rectangular prism.
Oh, thank you. Thank you for that.
You got it. Black rectangular prism. It is distressing. It's like if the monolith from 2001 was huge and then fell over.
Yes, correct.
And doesn't have a roof?
I think it has a roof. It's got to have a roof. But that's the winery.
The Google image search does not have a roof.
Huh.
Yeah, it looks weird. And then it just takes me to winegut.com.
Yeah, it's a really cool place. I would love to, because you're in this part of Austria is like agricultural, just it's farmland as far as the eye can see. And then you come around a bend, as it's been told to me, and you see this like spaceship looking cube.
It's a rectangular prism.
Shut up.
It's not a cube.
It's a rectangular prism. Let's move on.
It's a rectangular prism.
I like this wine. It sounds like you don't as much as I do.
It's fine. I don't dislike it. Let me give you my notes.
Yeah, talk to me about it.
My wine folly journal. So first of all, let's just do a check here. Intensity, medium, color intensity.
Yeah.
Medium. Hue, gold.
Definitely.
Yeah. Body. This is light bodied. Would you say?
I would say medium body.
Medium? It felt very not viscous to me. Not tannic, but there's some kind of astringency.
For
right?
sure.
There's some kind of not pleasant mouth bitter dryingness.
Phenolic bitterness.
Phenolic bitterness. Yes. That's right. Acidity, medium plus? Yep. Medium plus acidity? Alcohol, we know from the bottle that we're in the media. Was it like a 12%?
12.5, I think.
12.5?
Yeah.
And, all right, this is where I always get fucked. Sweet. It's sweet. A little bit sweet.
So I will say, I was not expecting this to be showing any perceptible residual sugar, but there is some.
I thought you loved this wine and that you have a longstanding relationship with this wine.
I do, but clearly there something happened this vintage that I didn't know about.
Okay. So you haven't had the, what is this?
The 2019.
This is the 2019?
Yeah.
You haven't had this prior. Okay.
But yeah, there's a little perceptible residual sugar, but not enough for me to even, I would still call it dry, just not bone dry. But there was more than I was expecting. Other vintages of this wine have been bone dry.
I will just always be mystified by that.
No, you'll get there.
Have
eventually.
We done any sweet wines on this show?
No.
Are we ever going to?
Yes, definitely.
Okay, great.
Oh, wait, no. We've done the 1,000-liter Riesling.
That was sweet.
That was, I would have called it off dry, but it definitely had sweetness.
Okay.
And the other Riesling,
Jamie, we've done 9 Rieslings on this show.
We've done, I think, 3.
We've done 9 Rieslings.
We've done the 1,000 liter.
We've done 20 rosés.
I'm just going to leave.
That would be fair.
I don't need to take this abuse.
That would be fair. Good night, everyone. Please rate, review, and subscribe. What else? So I had some notes. I had some like specific thoughts on the nose. Pineapple. I just always say pineapple when it's a white wine, but I was smelling pineapple. Granulated sugar.
Interesting.
Yeah.
We'll get into that one. I think that's a good call.
Tani, my wife, was picking up vanilla, which I'm not really getting, but between that, the pineapple and the granulated sugar, she thought it was like a pineapple fluff or like a pineapple upside down cake was like her recipe flavor smell. On the taste, there's something I'm getting that's vegetative.
Yes.
Is it like asparagus or kale? Some kind of like dark green thing that's like, it's like a low note, but it's there.
So a lot of people say a lot of different things. Asparagus is definitely one of the notes that people would say about this wine. For me, and I think this is partly because a lot of my vocabulary comes out of having worked in an Indian restaurant.
Yeah.
I think that this smells like lentils. Like,
interesting.
Like green lentils.
I have no idea what lentils smell like.
But asparagus, like fresh or canned, I think that this would lean more to the like canned asparagus aroma.
Canned asparagus. And then, Jamie, this is what your fucking shit-eating grin is about, is grapefruit. There's grapefruit. There are strong and unpleasant notes of grapefruit.
Yeah, there's big grapefruit flavor here.
And despite the big grapefruit energy, like I don't dislike the wine. It's just, I don't know.
It's not setting your toes a tapping?
No, it's fine. It smells nice. It's not particularly aromatic, right? Like
it's a little muted, yeah.
I was having trouble getting some schnuffin notes last night. Yeah, it's fine. It's light. It's kind of vibrant. It's enjoyable. It's pretty. It has intense legs or stems, which is the teardrops that trickle on the inside of your glass.
You just call them tears. So it's
grapefruit.
You're not enthusiastic about it, but you're fine with it.
it's fine. I'm as fine with this as I will ever be for something that tastes like a combination of asparagus and grapefruit.
Which really does not sound appealing.
No, because it has grapefruit.
Grapefruit is delicious. Once again, we're here at this crossroads where you're wrong and I'm right. And that's okay. I'm comfortable with it.
Grapefruit.
Super yummy.
I have nothing else. It's disgusting.
It's delicious.
Vile, and it's ruining this wine.
No, it's not. The wine's delicious. I really like this wine a lot. I think that I can see why you might be a little bit less enthusiastic about it. That vegetal note for me is like kind of a breath of fresh air. It's so different from other wines that I like to just explore that particular area of the flavor wheel. Anyway, so for me, the vegetal notes here, the lentil, the asparagus, and I think that there's also like a white pepper kind of aroma, which is something that I struggle to get, but it is known to me to be typical of Grüner Veltliner. All of these things, this sort of savory side, makes this interesting to me.
It is interesting. I won't say it's uninteresting.
Right.
Like, I spent enough time trying to figure out what the hell is in it. And again, I'm very suggestible. So you say white pepper and like, oh yeah, I guess there's white pepper in there.
I think this is the way, as I'm trained to blind taste, this is the way Grüner is supposed to present. You get that citrus note. I think there's also like a lemon lime flesh thing going on here. You get white pepper, you get lentils or asparagus or something vegetal. Maybe you lean into something tropical like pineapple, that pineapple upside down cake thing and granulated sugar thing that you and your wife were talking about. That for me is more like Pilsner, like beer kind of aroma that is indicative of Lees aging.
What is Lees aging?
Lees are the precipitated dead yeast cells that happen post fermentation, and leaving the wine with the lees for an extended period of time gives you a more complex aroma, but also a fuller body. That phenolic bitterness thing that you were talking about, that textural element of this wine, I think is very interesting and adds to the complexity, and also is a thing that helps this wine pair with food. This wine, I think, is really well suited to like bitter greens, like radicchio, things that can be a little bit off-putting. Mm-hmm. This wine sort of brings that in line. Or this wine is really great with like tinned fish, with like really, really salty things. So I think it's just a difference of experience. Like, I love this wine partly because it taught me what Grüner Veltliner is way back in the day, but also partly because it's such a breath of fresh air, because there really aren't wines like Grüner out there. It's pretty singular. And for you, I can see, like, when you start talking about things like canned asparagus, it's like, oh, this doesn't taste good.
Yeah. Or grapefruit, which is disgusting.
You better stop it.
I see what you're saying, but don't you think that's a little bit patronizing to say that it's a matter of experience?
Yes.
Yes. Okay. Like, because not all experienced wine professionals enjoy this wine, right?
No.
Yeah.
No.
So it's not just experience.
Well, it's specific. Specific experience.
I do like fundamentally understand what you're saying. Like, there are movies that I've tried to get people to watch, and some movies that I just won't share with some people because I know they haven't. Yeah, you experience more and more things, and your taste varies, and you're able to embrace and understand and like synthesize more complex or weirder things. Like, I get that.
Right.
But it's also fucking patronizing to say that to someone.
But also specifically, like the past experience that I just mentioned, that this is the wine that taught me about this grape.
Right.
That it existed and that wines could taste this way.
And that excites you?
Yeah. Learning new things excites me, Scott.
No, I know. I mean, this wine, though, like, I get that you have like a connection to it because this was your first Gravernal Leitzner.
Grüner Veltliner.
So like, who would you serve this to? Because I don't think it tastes good enough for me to want to get another bottle, and I don't think it's interesting enough for me to like keep spite drinking it the way I did with sherry, for example, where like the sherries I hate, but like in a fascinating way,
right?
Where like trying to figure out what's going on there. This is not exciting or interesting to me.
Well, so this is also a matter of just taste, not just experience, right?
So who
do I serve this to?
Yeah,
I
who
serve
is this the audience
to,
for this one?
I serve this to someone who I know likes Chablis. Chablis is a touchstone here because of the Lees aging.
Mm.
That sort of baking raw dough or Pilsner or like yeasty aroma is a benchmark in Chablis. So this would be a way to show them something different. Also Pinot Grigio, which we'll get into in our next miniseries.
Spoilers.
This would fall under the umbrella of neutral white wine. As you said, it's not particularly aromatic. It's a little bit muted. What happens with this wine mostly happens on the palate.
Mm.
It's about texture. And it's about savory character.
Is this yet another wine that is like dependent on food pairings?
I don't think it's dependent, but it definitely, like, some of the best experiences that I've had with Gruner mm-hmm. have been food experiences.
Mm.
But I also just like love it. I really do. I'm not just being obtuse by picking this wine. I really do genuinely love it. Like this is a wine that I would stock at home and keep in my fridge and open to watch a movie with, because I find it to be a pleasure to drink. It's a zippy white wine. You know, it's got acidity. You know, it has enough complexity to keep me interested, but not so much that I have to like pay attention to everything that's going on in the glass. Those are my feelings.
I think that's fair. It's like a low investment wine.
Right.
For you. You can just open it and go to town. Do you have thoughts, right?
I have so many thoughts.
Other than just disagreeing with me and patronizing me about my own notes and lack of experience about the wine.
Listen, you just admitted that there are movies that have that same thing.
Yeah, but I don't say that to people, or at least I don't
anymore.
You've
said it to me.
Well, because you're a
So here we are together, and right. I think you're a
Well, that's fair.
It's true on both counts. So what I wanted to talk about specifically with this wine is the concept of modernity. Capital M, modernity.
All right. I'm giving you some runway here. Go ahead.
I appreciate the runway.
Tell me about modernity in a wine.
What I find fascinating about this concept is that it means something different in a very obvious way year to year, right?
Like right. Our
concept of what is modern changes as we progress into the future. That right. makes sense.
Well, now we're post-postmodern, right?
Or whatever.
Yeah.
Post-post-post-postmodern.
Okay. But you don't mean modernity like the movement in in like the arts, right?
No, or
in,
I do not.
No, you so not capital M modernity.
Okay, sure. Yeah. You're right. Yes.
Yeah.
Modernity as it pertains to wine.
Okay, got it. And you're talking about whatever is contemporary, the contemporary trend in wine.
Right.
Okay.
Which changes not only moment to moment, but also place to place.
Hmm.
For example, we talked about Piedmont in
the Doctor Strangelove episode.
Okay. Yeah. And Piedmont's an interesting sort of microcosm for this. Because them being Italian, there was a very strong and like family splitting reaction to modernity. There were sides of families that decided they wanted to use new French oak barriques as opposed to the traditional fooders of the area. This literally ripped families asunder and people would not speak to one another.
Okay.
Things have calmed down since then.
They're no longer literally ripping families apart.
Correct.
That was a metaphor, Jamie. It was a metaphor. You got some Johnny Words bullshit going on, is all I'm saying.
You've got some Johnny Words bullshit.
You are destroying the meaning of the word literally, which is Johnny Words' brand.
Anyway, is Johnny Words' brand. You're
I
right.
apologize for derailing you once again.
I don't think that you're actually, this is not a genuine apology.
Well, I'm apologizing to me because I do want this episode to be done sooner, but.
Soon we're going to finish this recording. But
that's right.
So in the 80s, the modern movement was to have lower extraction, easier drinking, new oak aged red wines that we're quicker to market, that we're quicker to be able to open. The old way of doing things necessitated extremely long bottle aging before the wines were drinkable. Now they've found sort of a middle ground. Some people are still very traditional. Some people are still modern, and technology progresses, and so, you know, cellar hygiene becomes a thing, and you know, they're moving into the 21st century with newer and newer techniques where there is not as much of a kickback from the previous generation. Now think about Bordeaux, okay, where new French oak has always been the thing. That is part of the character of Bordeaux, okay, and kind of has always been. And only now are you starting to see stainless steel aged Bordeaux that are made for quick, easy drinking.
So Bordeaux is like behind the times because they're traditional and they don't need to be modern.
No, it's just different. The concept of modern versus traditional in Bordeaux in the 80s wasn't a conversation. Now it is, due to the advent of new technologies, but it's not such a huge divide. And the thing that was called traditional, this new oak aging, was called modern in Piedmont.
Okay.
See what I'm saying?
Yeah. Right. So everybody's behind the times, basically. It's why they still have discos in Germany. And why...
Sure.
No, but like it's, yes, yeah, so some places are...
You're talking about the same technique.
Yeah.
Right? One place calls it traditional, one place calls it modern.
Right.
And it's just based on the culture of that particular area. And I think it's interesting that interplay exists, that mm-hmm. that there isn't a level playing field across the wine world. I also think that Loimer fits in at an interesting time in Austrian wine. So in 1985, there was a scandal that broke in the Austrian wine industry. Austrian winemakers were adding diethylene glycol to their wines as a way of increasing body.
Now, Jamie, I'm not a chemist.
Yes.
This may come as a surprise to you and our listeners.
Shocked, actually. I've known you to have a sharp scientific mind.
That's right. Shut up. But those phonemes stitched together don't sound like a food thing. What is diethylene ethylflonachon?
Diethylene glycol, okay, is toxic and is an ingredient in antifreeze.
But is that what makes antifreeze viscous?
Yes.
It makes it like syrupy?
Yeah.
And they were putting that in wine?
Correct.
Why?
To increase the body, to give it a fuller mouthfeel. Yep. Well, this was during the 80s, during a time when the modern thing, like this is an era of large scale commercial production as the thing that is most dominant in Austrian wine. You know, we're coming off of like mid-century America where big agriculture and factory farms and all of that came to the fore, and some of that culture has migrated over to Europe, and specifically in wine because of the American market for consumables like wine.
Right. So everybody's amping up production.
Right. And part of that means lower quality, and lower quality means adding things to the wine so that it's palatable. And so some people were adding diethylene glycol, and it was bad. This tanked the export market for Austrian wine.
Did it not also tank the human beings who drank wine that had fucking antifreeze in it?
No one died, to my knowledge, but it wasn't good.
Okay. Look, it's not that I want someone to have died.
Right.
But at a certain point, I would like you to say there was a scandal in this country's wine industry at a time and have it add up to something more than like stupid nonsense. Because most of the wine scandals sound dumb. So like, I don't know, like maybe you're trying to keep the body count low because this show is frequently a bummer. I'm very sorry. But are there any wine scandals that aren't just like harmless funsies?
I mean, this wasn't harmless. This is a toxic thing.
Okay.
It's nice that it was added in low enough levels where no one died.
Right. Which I'm glad for.
It's good.
Which I'm glad for.
But it sounds like you're a little bloodthirsty.
It's just that every time you say there's a scandal in wine, I'm increasingly likely to snicker because I'm like, oh, he calls it a scandal. But what it really means is that some French people wrote laws to keep UFOs from landing on their wine crops.
Like, I mean, yeah, it's all silly because people take wine really seriously.
Right.
A lot of the stupid shit you talk about in movies is really silly because people take movies really fucking seriously. For no discernible reason. It's a silly thing. These are things that we don't need to survive, Scott.
Speak for yourself, Jamie. Okay. Speak for yourself. Anyway, I apologize. I'm not bloodthirsty. I don't want anyone to die. Please continue.
So the scandal breaks and it ruins, deservedly, obviously, the export market for Austrian wine. And so
how did it break? It broke because people got sick?
It broke because a testing facility detected these wines, like, on their way out of the country.
I will just never understand how people think they can get away with this shit. Like, the testing people won't notice that we're putting antifreeze components in our wine. It's fine. It's fine.
People have the audacity. It's pretty crazy.
But so what happened then as a result of the
scandal? Well, as a result, they dumped out millions of bottles of wine that couldn't be sold because they had toxic shit in them.
Right.
And then the global market, you know, all basically collectively decided to stop buying Austrian wine altogether.
Mm.
And so the Austrian wine industry had to either react or die. And their reaction was to largely stop making bulk wine and focus much more upmarket and quality oriented. Some people did that by literally modernizing their facilities and making sure that they had the proper equipment in the field to get the ripeness that they wanted from the grapes that they were harvesting, and make wines that were clean and presented without flaw all the time. That frequently meant also herbicides, commercially available yeasts, stainless steel tanks, like nothing that is overtly horrible or bad. You know, you have to have some amount of intervention in agriculture, but the things that I don't love in wine because I care about regenerative agriculture and sustainability and all of those things. So some people went the more technology-focused way, and other people like Fred Loimer, who was really on the front lines of this, went, we're going to look backwards a little bit. We're going to think about respecting the land. We're going to think about regenerative agriculture. We're going to embrace the use of native yeast and spontaneous fermentations. We're going to use lower additives, really pay attention at every step of the process to make sure that we're getting it right, but try to use less intervention on the way to the bottle.
I'm trying to remember all the various trends you've talked about. Is that a natural wine thing? So he's a natural wine guy.
One of the first.
One of the first in Austria or in the world?
In Austria.
Okay.
An organization that I mentioned before called Respect Biodyne, which is the Austrian certifying body for biodynamic agriculture.
This is R-E-S-P-E-K-T. Yeah, I read the packet you put together for me.
You know, it's impressive that he was so much on the forefront and so direct in the path. He had started working in the vineyards and in the winery when it belonged to his father in the late 80s. And then once it was his turn to take over, immediately purchased a new cellar, which was a traditional hand-dug cellar, which he built this monolith that we talked about before.
The rectangular prism.
Yes. And went directly in the direction of sustainable agriculture and sort of never looked back. He's refined some of his winemaking techniques along the way as the vineyards have become healthier. He filters less, leaves more solids in contact with the wine during fermentation because it creates a cleaner product at the very end.
What is racking?
Racking is moving wine from one tank to another, the object being leaving behind solids in the previous tank.
So this is in the ballpark of the Solera mechanism from sherry making.
It's a little
wine
bit
from one tank to the other.
You're moving wine from one tank to the other, sure.
It's in the ballpark. It's in the ballpark.
Yes.
It's not 18 tiers of Solera filtering it's moving thing from one.
A better analogy.
All right.
Is decanting.
Okay.
So sometimes you're decanting to aerate, but when you decant an old wine, the big object is to separate the wine from the chungus.
Ah.
So you're carefully pouring the wine out of the bottle so that you don't have solids in your glass, which is what you're doing in racking.
Okay.
It just involves much, much larger volumes of wine.
But isn't that what filtering is? Isn't filtering about getting chungus out?
It is.
So racking and filtering are the same?
They are different things.
Okay. I feel like I'm not going to get a satisfactory answer here, so let's continue.
They're different things with the same object.
To get the chungus out.
To get the chungus out.
Fair enough. I am now satisfied.
I don't think you are.
I mean, I got to say chungus, so I'm pretty good.
Okay, good, good, good. That's kind of what I have to say about modernity as it comes to Loimer. He has been a leader, continues to be a leader, continues to make adjustments to make sure that the wines present the way that he wants them to present. This bottling being his, it's not the entry level, it's the one just above that. This is what he would call Ortswein or village wine.
What does that mean?
It means it is wine specifically from one village. On the bottle, it says Langenlois, which is the village that the winery resides in, but also the village that all of these grapes come from.
In Langenlois.
Langenlois.
So there's...
There's a regional wine that he makes called Lois.
I saw that one on internet. Yeah.
That one comes from all over Niederösterreich, which is Lower Austria, the Danube River Valley.
And that's the appellation.
That is one appellation.
And this is... And then this Langenlois is...
Langenlois is a village. The appellation that it resides in is Comptal.
Comptal. Okay.
These things are very confusing.
Yeah. Well, especially since they're not the same in
any
two places.
Oh my God,
world.
It's so bad.
Yeah.
It's so bad.
You know, it's 2021. It's globalization station. Oh my God, Jamie, when this episode comes out, it's 2022.
Yep, that's correct.
But anyway, I feel like we should just all get on board and, you know, it's a global market. Maybe everyone should use, if not the same terms, at least have the terms mean roughly the same things.
That would be nice.
I don't really care if it's a problem for you, but it's increasingly confusing for me.
Right. It's confusing for everybody, and it's a major barrier for entry for just enjoying wine.
Yeah. This is a white table wine, the bottle says.
Yes.
What is the difference between a table wine and a non-table wine?
Anything other than that?
Yeah. Is it just like it's table wine is like dinner wine? It's just casual, everyday prol wine?
Table wine is generally dry wine.
Table wine means dry.
Generally, depending on the place. But here in Austria, this means this is a dry wine, as opposed to a sweet wine or a dessert wine or a fortified wine. And those tend to be taxed differently. It's more of a money thing, of a tax bracket situation than anything. Here in the United States, sparkling wine is considered to be a luxury product and is taxed at a different rate than other wine.
Even though it's still grape juice in a bottle.
Correct.
That's made largely the same as anything else.
Yes.
Okay.
Yep.
Cool.
Super dumb.
You picked a real weird industry to get into.
Sure did. I wish I had known how weird it was before I dove fucking hip deep into it.
Yeah.
So like the modern zeitgeist, the contemporary zeitgeist now for me and for many of my colleagues is towards more natural, regenerative, sustainable wines. And that frequently involves looking to the past, right, as far as technique is concerned.
Right. Because 100 years ago, what you're describing is like a trend in natural wines is just how wine was always made.
Correct. But, you know, before Roundup and before machinery and before vertical shoot positioning and
industrial agriculture.
Exactly.
And, yeah. Seems like a lot of bad things have happened in the 20th century.
Yes, that is correct.
Like not all of the bad things, but.
But many of the bad things.
Yeah. Many of the bad things.
Many of the bad things that that broadly affect billions of people.
Right. Many good things as well.
Yeah, sure. But
also many,
so,
many,
so
many,
much,
many,
so much fucking bad.
Many bad things.
And all of those bad things are still extraordinarily commonplace.
Yeah.
You know, wines that are conscientiously made are not the things that get sold the most or made the most.
Right. Well, because you can't make the most of them.
Right.
Because you can't be conscientious when you're making something for a mass market.
Correct.
Yeah.
Everything sucks. It's all bad.
It's not great.
So
In the research you put together for me, it said that Loimer leans towards spontaneous fermentation.
Yes.
What does that mean? We've talked about native yeast. Is this native yeast?
Yes.
So this is just leaving the yeast that's naturally occurring and is on every surface on the planet at all times and definitely gives me nightmares. We just leave that alone. That's spontaneous fermentation.
That is spontaneous fermentation, but it gets just slightly more complex than that.
Okay.
Spontaneous fermentation is leaving grape juice to ferment with no further intervention.
At all.
At all.
No intervention of any variety.
Just press it or crush it and allow it to ferment.
Okay.
If you leave a thing out that has sugar content, it will ferment. If you left a strawberry on your kitchen table, it would ferment.
I'm familiar.
Yes.
That is gross.
It has happened in this house.
I don't know that I could recognize fermentation if it happened in front of me. I just mean the strawberry is the example you've given me before.
Right.
I guess Jamie just loves leaving strawberries out.
I also kind of like the smell of fermented strawberries.
You're such a weirdo. You are so deep in your own shit. What you're saying is I really like the smell of rotten bad fruit.
Yes, correct.
Okay, great.
I mean, that's what wine is. It's rotten. It's bad. But that's a way of preserving it. Anyway, I'm not going to get on my soapbox about it right now.
Okay.
This moment.
All right. So that's spontaneous. That's
spontaneous fermentation. And that can happen with anything. That can happen with cider. That can happen with beer. That can happen with produce that's left out for too long. And that is native yeast fermentation.
Right. That is the native yeast.
Right. Native yeast fermentation can also be a winemaker or someone in the area has taken a culture of yeast from the vineyard and cultured it in a laboratory and then reintroduced it to the grape juice in order to start a quicker fermentation.
That feels dishonest. That doesn't sound...
It's a little bit dishonest.
Yeah, to my deep and comprehensive understanding of native yeast fermentation, that sounds like a lie.
It's a way to make sure that, like during the culture, you can weed out perhaps strains of yeast that exist that are spoilage yeasts that you don't want to even have any influence.
So that's like selective native yeast fermentation.
It can be literally just taking the culture and doing it that way because adding it in a particular quantity will kick off a strong, faster fermentation than spontaneous fermentation, which can be quite slow and dangerous. If it's slow enough, those spoilage yeasts can get a foothold early and crowd out the good yeasts that you want to end the fermentation with. Spontaneous fermentation is by its nature very risky. Using a culture is a way to make it safer and make sure that you get a return on the investment into this grape juice.
I don't really care about spontaneous fermentation anymore. Now I'm just like low grade incensed that again, per my deep understanding conveyed to me by you about native yeast, it sounds like we're really twisting the branding of native yeast fermentation.
It's not that much of a twist though. Like you're literally going out into the vineyard and taking a sample of the yeast that exists in the vineyard and then just making a culture of it such that there is a bigger population to start your fermentation quicker. The other way of doing that is to use the pied de cuve method, foot of the cuvée.
And the cuvée is the what now?
The wine. The wine to be made, the particular batch of wine that you're working on.
The cuvée is the wine?
Yep.
I thought it was like a vessel or a object.
No. It's not an object. It is the, like, if I've got two tanks of wine that are going to be bottled separately, that's two cuvées.
I thought the cuvée was like the barrel or something, or the fermentation chamber.
It's the volume of wine within the stuff. Yes.
Correct. Okay.
So the pied de cuve method, you crush, press your wine or your grape juice, and then draw off a little bit of it into a bucket, say, and allow a spontaneous fermentation to start in that bucket. A smaller volume of wine will always start a fermentation quicker than a large volume of wine.
That makes sense.
So that then you add that back to your larger vessel, which is the same principle as the cultured yeast method that I described before. You have a larger population of yeast going to give you a quicker start.
All right. I'll allow all of this. This all sounds fine. It sounds like some bullshit, but okay. Not what, the spontaneous fermentation
the,
part.
The middle one.
Now I'm really just mad that native yeast doesn't mean what I thought it meant.
I mean, it means the yeast that exists in the place that the wine comes from.
And then has been sampled off and cultured and maybe filtered out to take out the bad yeast and then added back in larger quantities.
Sure, yeah.
I don't know, native yeast just sounded like a trendy, you know, modern way of saying we're doing something that's more natural and closer to the place and what's right. naturally occurring, but it's not really the naturally occurring yeast if you have to like pre-cultivate it.
It is the naturally occurring yeast.
It's the yeast from that place.
Right.
But then we're fucking with it.
Right.
Yeah.
It's a little bit dishonest, but for me, it's within the margin. It's better than getting one strain of Saccharomyces from a yeast distributor and adding that for like a particular character for getting the complexity that can be brought by multiple strains.
All right. You have answered this question and many more at great length. Thank you.
Is it time for wife takes?
It might be. It might be time for the wife takes. Are you prepared?
I mean, I don't prepare for wife takes. They just kind of happen in my direction and yeah. I react the way that I react.
Reasonable. Well, this game, Wife Takes, is a way to recreate my wife Tani's favorite way to antagonize Jamie at his restaurants, where she would come up with absurdly pretentious and flowery descriptions of the wines that he would serve us as a way to mock him and his delicate somm sensibilities. Now, as part of this miniseries, I think in part to entertain herself, my wife has decided to instead follow my lead with the end of the world. And instead of talking about the wine, we're really just talking about all the ways that Jamie could die in a post-apocalyptic or, you know, present day apocalyptic scenario.
Let's be very clear. This whole thing is just to entertain herself. She has no other dog in this fight.
Yeah, but some of them were about like contributing to, you know, a lively and spirited, thoughtful discourse about wine and also make fun of you. And this has nothing to do.
Yeah.
This is just for funsies for her, and it is delightful. And I hope we continue with this trend. So, question number one, and she prefaces, these are all open-ended questions, meaning that she does not have a correct answer that she's aiming for you to guess. Number one, which of the following is how you, Jamie, die in the zombie apocalypse?
Okay.
A, you are a first wave casualty and a very early zombie. Someone civic-minded decapitates you early on for the greater good.
Okay.
The greater good. B, you are a later casualty. A zombie eats you and then gets acute alcohol poisoning and a wicked case of the spins. It's pretty good.
Glad she ended with spins.
Right. C, correctly assuming that society will have bigger fish to fry, someone takes the zombie apocalypse as a good excuse to murder you as a preemptive strike. And she is like really pointing the finger at me with that one here without saying it.
Yeah.
So do you die first wave? Do you get eaten, you know, later on by the zombies and then give a zombie alcohol poisoning? Or does someone, probably me, just murder you because the cops aren't looking?
Well, consistent with everything that I've said so far, I think that first wave is the way that I go. Although I find number two to be quite attractive as well. The idea of a zombie eating me in the second wave.
And then just getting drunk instantly.
Yes, correct. Yeah.
Suddenly the zombie's liver just like falls out and then other zombies eat it.
Well, I mean, let's be real. If I don't die in the first wave, I'm getting drunk.
Yeah, that's pretty reasonable. Number two, Jamie, you've got red on you. Is it A, wine, B, blood, or C, ink? And as a follow-up question, which type of red wine is it?
Well, red wine stains really don't come across as red.
That's true.
They're pretty purpley
brown.
Yeah. Yeah. And if we're talking about zombie apocalypse, I would think blood. But then again, we're talking about me here. I'm going to go with red ink.
Really?
Yeah.
Why?
We've got red pens.
So, Jamie. One
right here.
Yeah.
It's a red pen.
Jamie, using that exact same pen, which is that a Pilot G2?
It is a Pilot G2.
Pilot G2 red gel pen. So you may recall many years ago, I went as Shaun of the Dead for a work Halloween party.
Yes.
My first year, like really working for the Philadelphia Film Festival, and the festival overlapped with Halloween that year. And I went as Shaun, and I was at work at my theater all day long. But I had already planned this out, and I had my cricket bat with me, my trusty cricket bat that's right here. But I took a white short sleeve, like button down shirt, and just hung it up in the box office and put that pen with the thing clicked down, just like Sean did in the movie. And it took all fucking day for a red ink stain to actually like pool. And I think by the end of it, I really just had to like color it in with the ink to make it work.
Huh. All right. So
yeah,
blood and no, red wine. Fuck it. Like,
yeah. Come on, Jamie. Come on.
I'm very clumsy. Are we kidding? I spill shit a lot. Yeah. I get red wine on me a lot. That's why I don't wear white really ever.
Number three, what is your go-to coping wine?
Oh boy.
This question frightens me. Like, if zombies are a real and growing problem, but not a this minute problem, what wine do you open first to help deal with apocalyptic shit? This is a good question.
It's just a good question in general
for this miniseries.
Yes.
What's your go-to coping mechanism wine?
At the risk of being too aggressively on brand, it's Zinfandel.
It's Zinfandel.
It's 100% Zinfandel. First of all, I've got by far the most of that in my cellar at home. Mm-hmm. But also, it's high alcohol, it's plush, you can get drunk easily, and it's viscerally satisfying.
All right. Good answer. If anybody was curious, I would find all of the bourbon and just keep drinking until it was time to barricade the windows. Number four, in the post-zombie apocalypse, does your wine-adjacent business hire a zombie? And if so, do you pay this zombie a wage even though it doesn't need or understand money anymore? Or do you take short-term but lucrative advantage of what is essentially a new type of slavery, subsequently flooding the labor market and crippling the alive people economy in general, but firmly establishing your brand and personal fortune? Man, she is putting you on the spot here.
This is really, truly fucked up.
Yep.
No, I don't.
You don't traffic in zombie slaves?
No.
No?
I do not.
But Jamie, they're the undead.
Yeah.
They don't have souls. They don't have rights. They don't have feelings.
They might have souls or feelings. Obviously, they don't have rights, but that's not a thing for me, legally speaking. Like, I don't give a shit about the law.
Human rights are not a thing for you?
I don't give a shit about the law, is my point.
Ah, okay. You're better than the law.
Correct.
The law is not what limits you morally.
Listen, if the law is not giving rights to beings that are shambling around, I'm still going to recognize them as beings.
That is dangerously progressive of you, Jamie. Also, I feel like zombies would be terrible food service professionals.
It's not appetizing.
No, because they're undead and they're rotting.
You don't want someone who is rotting
and
yeah.
bleeding and trying to eat you all the
time. Sounds bad.
I have my own question to add on to this here.
Oh.
And this is by far, this is something I've been thinking about a little bit. But so Jamie.
Yes.
Zombie apocalypse. Let's say that you and I are not like Sean and his cohorts in the movie and like tuning out and changing the channel and ignoring everything.
Right.
Zombie apocalypse. The news breaks. What's your game plan?
I don't have a game plan.
Come on, Jamie. You got to have a plan. Even fucking Sean has a game plan. He's got to go rescue mom, round up Liz, and then
wait for it to all blow over.
Like, what's your game plan? Where do you go? Who do you saddle up with? What gear do you need?
I don't know. I feel like just get away from the coast and populated areas is like the first thing.
That's my game plan for most disaster scenarios and just long-term for the future.
Right.
If there's any listeners out there with property that's inland and away from large population centers, please let me know.
Don't let him know. He's coming for you.
Mm.
I think that's the first, you know, you grab provisions from wherever you can.
Yeah.
Food and clothing and all the things and gas. All the things you need. And a weapon.
I need a weapon.
Scott is brandishing the cricket bat that he owns.
That was a gift from you.
That's correct.
Was it you and Dumpy who gave this to me?
It was me and
you and gave this to me.
As a reference to
Shaun of the Dead. Yeah. This was what's his name? John Larroquette threatening to beat people with a cricket bat. Inappropriate workplace conduct there.
Very
White House counsel, John Larroquette.
Walking around with a weapon threatening to beat people with it.
I will kill you with this cricket bat.
Yep.
Yeah.
It's not good.
Nope. Not a great look.
But we thought it was very entertaining.
Yeah. And a few concussions later, I was no longer allowed to bring that to parties or outside of my room.
He carried it everywhere.
It had a holster, Jamie. What do you want from me? It came with a scabbard and a strap. Like, am I not going to carry it around on my back like a boss who definitely knows how cricket is played?
Also, nothing you did back then could have been described as like a boss.
I don't know. I wore the hell out of that gigantic oversized leather jacket.
Sure. Let's go with that.
Like a teacher on a 90s sitcom.
Exactly. Yeah, so get a weapon, get provisions, head inland.
Yeah.
Find a place to be that is not populated.
Yeah. You know that friend of the show, who definitely listens to the show, there's rumblings that he's been working on a bunker.
He is 100% working on a bunker.
Yeah, he denies it because he probably shouldn't have talked about it openly, but he's working on a bunker.
When we get him drunk, he alludes to things.
Yeah. I have not been invited to or offered any kind of shelter at this bunker come the end times.
Right. No, it'll be him alone.
No. I think he's invited people. And I think you and I have not been invited because we have no demonstrable, marketable survival skills.
You think it's that? Or do you think it's all of the crimes that we've committed against him?
Are they crimes? Jamie, I don't give a shit what the law says, okay? So anyway, I guess I'm really only bringing this up as a way to commit to you and to our listening audience who's fully invested in our antagonistic relationship with that when the end times come, I'm fucking showing up on his front doorstep with
your cricket bat.
With this cricket bat, and you can bring several cases of wine and we'll take over and kick him out of his bunker just like they do to Flanders in that episode of The Simpsons.
That is an apt comparison.
Yeah.
Yeah.
We'll kick his little ass out.
He's just a little guy.
He'll be fine.
He will let us in due to the cases of wine. Like he needs alcohol.
He'll let you in.
Right. But I'll make sure that, or you'll like hide in my shadow or something and come in behind me.
That's always worked well for me. Hiding. All right. The pairing.
Time to talk about the pairing.
So to pair this, do we think the pairing is successful? I told you many things about it, many of which I have repeated already. But to kind of get you in the headspace to pair something to this movie, I talked a lot about the precision of Edgar Wright as a filmmaker, the way that he shoots the movies in his head first, that he's got it all kind of like in his brain before they even start rolling cameras. We talked about the sincerity, that it's like heartfelt and the jokes come from like natural situational comedy and not from parody or like making fun of the genre. And yeah, what of that did you take when you tried to do pairing?
Okay, so the things that I took from that are precision, meticulous, sincerity, and not a parody. If all of the Loimer wines have like a common thread between them, it's precision, both precision in production and also in the way they present on the palate. From the vineyard to the winery, every step is meticulous and precise. The agriculture is done with an eye for the future, and the wines are made with an eye for the future. Fred and his wife Birgit like to think of their approach for the winery and the vineyards and the wines as these are grandchild suitable, meaning that when their grandchildren are able to take over, these things will be healthy and ready for them.
Ah, okay. Not that these are good kid table wines.
No.
Okay. Understood.
So when you're doing something looking for such a long-term result, every move makes a difference. Every shoot that you prune, every time you till, every leaf that you pull, every bunch that you drop, every single tank that you clean or decision that you make in the racking or movement of wines and then the precise date of bottling and like everything along the way is done with an eye for what's this going to be in 20, 30, 40 years and beyond. And I think that precision and meticulousness.
I prefer your first way.
Meticulosity.
Meticulosity.
I like it too, but it definitely.
Meticulaciousness. No. No, that's bad.
I think all of that leads to a wine that presents the way they intended it to. It has this really direct acidity and sort of a direct path down the palate. And there are precisely zero flaws in this wine. It does not have any kind of negative volatile acidity or Brettanomyces or like any of the things that could be qualified as flaws are purposefully absent from this wine. In that pursuit, I think you find the sincerity. They're not doing this to dunk on the previous like commercial agriculture. This isn't an act of defiance for the previous generation. This is just a forward looking, we want to do best by ourselves and our people.
Now I'm going to do the thing that I always do,
which is interrogate me.
Right. Do you detect sincerity in the glass? No, and I'm like sincerely asking, because like, so you're talking about stuff that's like metatextual, right? Like things is the sincerity something that like, and I'm genuinely not breaking your balls here. Like, cause you, like you were saying, you have more experience than I do. Can you drink this and say that I detect that Loimer is being sincere in what they're trying to create here? Cause like, I don't need to have seen all the Edgar Wright movies and read a whole fucking doorstop of a book about the making of this movie to know that this is a sincere movie.
Right.
Right. Like I just watched the movie and boom, sincerity. Is sincerity something that is in wine? Like is this like flowery metaphor, or can you actually detect their intent just in the consumption of it? It's genuinely sincere question.
Right. I would like to say yes, but like if you gave me a blind lineup of commercially produced Gruner versus what I would consider to be conscientiously sincere produced Gruner, I probably would miss about half the time. I think it's a combination of the way this wine presents and a knowledge of the agriculture behind it that allows me to perceive that sincerity. Without a label, without context, probably couldn't.
Well, intent is difficult in all things.
It is.
Detecting and inferring and particularly assuming intent.
In food and beverage, you know, this is just a substance that was made, and it was made with a particular intent. And I think that the quality comes through. And in that, I can detect some amount of sincerity, whether it's like the sincerity directed at wanting to create something very good or wanting to create something conscientious. That is a thing that I probably couldn't differentiate between.
Between wanting to make something good and wanting to make something conscientious.
Correct.
I don't know that I understand.
So when I taste this wine, if I'm tasting it blind, I can taste that it is a very high quality wine.
Right. You can detect that it's good.
That it is well made by someone skilled.
Okay.
But to then determine whether it is well made by someone skilled in a conventional way without an eye for regenerative agriculture or the future generations of their family, mm-hmm, versus what I've described about the Loimer family, that jump I couldn't make.
Okay. What is an insincere wine to you?
An insincere wine would be some of the worst offenders of, and I dunk on Napa Cabernet a lot and I feel bad about it because there's so much that I like, but some of the worst offenders of big Napa Valley Cabernet, these wines that cost $200 to $400 a bottle that are extraordinarily skillfully made by professionals. And they have very polished front-facing sales teams and web presences, and they have sort of constructed a story around the winery. But the story is basically always the same. A very, very rich person wanted to own a farm.
Right.
That to me is insincere.
Because of the origins of the vineyard?
Because it's vanishingly rare that particular motivation is anything more than vanity.
So a sincere wine, in your estimation, is from somebody who wants to make wine.
Correct.
And an insincere wine is somebody who wants to make money and they see wine as an avenue to getting that.
Or they already have money, uh-huh, and they see wine as a way to get clout or produce an image about themselves.
Okay. But does this have anything to do with trends? Like you were talking about the Napa Cabs.
No.
Like you're not saying that something might be insincere because they're just following a trend that other people are doing and they're not following their passions. You're just talking about the intent behind even getting into making the wine in the first place.
And the reason I use Napa as an example is that is a magnet for that type of person. Because of the prestige of that area.
Sounds like you might have a bit of a problem with wealthy people, Jamie.
I do. Eat the rich. Fuck them.
They probably taste really good.
Yep.
All that fancy food.
It's like foie gras up in here.
From what you're saying conceptually, I think you really have a good conceptual pairing here. I think everything you're describing about the winemaking and the intent and the precision at every step in the process, yep, like that fucking, that sounds like Edgar Wright. You know, he's mega precise guy from the page. Like he knows exactly from the beginning exactly what the end result is, and he knows every step of the process that needs to get done to achieve that.
Yeah, that was one of the original things that I was thinking about when I picked this wine is the idea, like what I know about Edgar Wright and what I know about Fred Loimer, like the idea of them sitting down together and like watching a movie and drinking a bottle of wine. I think that there would be good chemistry between the two of them.
Do you need me to explain to you what chemistry is?
No, we already did that.
Yeah. Uh-huh. We made a little joke about science chemistry earlier. This is the chemistry episode.
It is.
But so, you know, what actually matters to our listener, aside from the conceptual, do the two objects pair?
I don't think they interact at all.
No.
I don't think there's any line that you can draw while you're watching this movie and drinking this wine, just like from a naked images and sounds, aromas and flavors thing. There's nothing. It's a blank.
It's a non-pairing.
I enjoy drinking this wine and I enjoy watching that movie. And so it was pleasant. Yeah. We've been here before.
We have. Do you have an alternate, having, you know, rewatched the movie recently and realizing that this pairing doesn't play? Do you have something else?
Something else. I mean, it's easy to think about red wine, especially because the color red is so prevalent in this movie. But I think it's probably more fun just to like make a bunch of cocktails while you're watching this movie. Mm. Like this movie is great to watch with friends, have a bunch of drinks together and, you know, maybe pause the movie and talk about what the drink is for like a half a minute and then keep going and then pause because you're laughing too hard and drink a little bit more and make a new cocktail. You know, I think that would be a better way to enjoy beverage alcohol with this movie.
Beverage alcohol. You wouldn't go the obvious route and just do beer because they drink a lot of pints in the movie.
That would also kind of be a nothing pairing.
You don't think beer would go well with this?
There's no interplay. Like the beer that they're drinking is like basic British lager.
Yeah.
Other than watching them drink beer while you're also drinking beer, it's kind of a nothing thing.
A signature of an Edgar Wright movie, aside from like style and taste and like worldview, is energy, right? Like his movies all have, they're high energy, they're kinetic, they're fast. Can you think of like a wine that would match the kinetics or the energy or the pace of this movie?
Well, usually when you start talking about kinetics, energy, and pace, I start thinking about acid profiles because that for me is like the analog for speed. Like I had seen this movie before, and that's part of the reason why I picked this wine, knowing that acid was a major component here.
But then
maybe I would lean even farther into it and, you know, get like a really piercing, like a Chenin Blanc from the Loire Valley, ooh, something like from Mont-Louis that's just like minerals and sharpness. But even there, I don't know. I think you would like that wine more.
Yeah. I mean, I like Chenin Blanc more than I like grapefruit asparagus butt.
Grapefruit asparagus butt.
Yeah. That'll be my rap name.
I think making a bunch of cocktails with friends is like, and I think key to a great watching experience of this movie is experiencing it with other people.
I mean, that's the thing, right? Like,
and that's why I talk about cocktails. It's that convivial like atmosphere.
Yeah.
Yeah.
People like huddled around the kitchen and watching all the ingredients coming together.
Yep.
And cocktails are party. Yeah. I mean, I think many movies, if not all, but most benefit from watching them with some kind of audience, whether or not it's like a big audience. I was telling you earlier, I just had my return to theaters and I saw House of Gucci and it was just like, it was great watching the audience figure out over the course of the movie that like, oh yes, we should be laughing at this. Like,
right.
It looks and sounds like a straight drama, but then they start moving their mouths and doing silly things and Jared Leto's on screen and yeah. Audiences are great. I like them. I'm glad to have them back. All right. Well, so that's I think you're, yeah, cocktails. Cocktails make sense.
I think
to
that
me.
Would be a really fun experience. And I'm thinking specifically of like some of our friends. You know, like if you and Tani and friends of the show, Pri and Adam and Dan Marino and Laura and me were like all here and we like paused the movie for a second, came down here and like Adam made a cocktail that he was experimenting with. And then mm-hmm. we watched a half hour with those cocktails. And then we came downstairs and I did something different. Mm-hmm. And then we went back. Like that would be a really fun way to go through this movie.
No, go fuck yourself.
You hate pausing movies because you're a weird purist.
If it was meant to be stopped every 30 minutes, it would be called television, Jamie.
Okay.
You just described a profoundly offensive scenario for me.
I know you. I know.
You know,
it would be fun.
You know, it would be a better pairing for Shaun of the Dead is if we sat down and watched the entire movie and had a really nice bottle of wine. But first I put it under the radiator for like a half hour and then poured it on the floor and then kind of wet vacked it out of the carpet and then poured that back into everybody's glass.
We're going to have this discussion out one of these times.
I think we've had it several times.
Well, but we're going to like for real have it.
Yeah.
Let's move the fuck on. Otherwise, you know, you're armed right now, and I don't want to have this argument with you while you're armed.
I can't quite reach you, though. You're too far away.
We always do a double feature in a second glass.
A little bit of a double feature.
Yes. So what's the next movie?
So, I mean, assuming one has already seen
Hot Fuzz and the World's End.
Hot Fuzz and the World's End. This is a left turn, but Jamie, have you ever seen any Jacques Tati movies?
No, sir.
You ever seen like Monsieur Hulot's Holiday? Nope. or Playtime, which is like his fucking magnum opus?
Nope.
So this is a French comedian and comedy filmmaker, Jacques Tati, and I would recommend people check out his movie Playtime, which is one of my favorite movies ever made, ever. As of this recording, it is streaming on the Criterion Channel. It's basically a silent comedy about modernity. Tati's signature character, Monsieur Hulot, arrives in like this like glass and steel high-rise version of Paris and is just kind of bumbling his way through like modern living and through escalators and elevators and new restaurants going up, and he just kind of he bumbles and he shuffles and he's awkward, but like an Edgar Wright comedy, the compositions are immaculate and the edits are great and the jokes come out of not just performances and physicality but about framing and about contrast and about jokes coming from the edit. And while the like the kinetics and the energy level of Edgar Wright is not present in this movie, at least not until it's uproarious and bonkers last like 20 minutes, that's set in a restaurant on its opening night where basically everything is falling apart and everybody gets drunk and has a great time while the restaurant is collapsing around them, essentially.
That sounds like a nightmare.
Oh, but it's so funny. We've talked a lot about how modern comedy has no like real filmmaking authorial intent behind it. And Tati is somebody who I would put on a spectrum with Edgar Wright as like a masterful visual formalist who still gets crazy jokes. And Tati, there's nothing he wouldn't do to get a joke. He'll get a verbal joke. He'll get a pun out of a sign. He'll have jokes coming out of like slapstick and broad, silly comedy. And it's all very sharp and very shrewd. And it's a fucking movie that bankrupted him and destroyed his career, even though it's a goddamn masterpiece.
That is a shame.
Jacques Tati's Playtime.
Hate that for Jacques.
You should watch it.
Sounds great.
It's super good. What about, let's say, even though the pairing didn't work, what if people want more Gruner Flooner, Jamie? What else should they get?
So Gruner is expressed this way from Comptal. I said before that I thought that this was really indicative of the wines of the area. And if you want to dive into what Gruner can do, you want to like take a step up to the next level. There's an area just to the west of Comptal called the Vacau. And the Vacau is probably the most iconic place for Gruner to be produced. There's a codified system of ripeness in the same way that there is in Germany. And FX Pichler, for me, is a pretty foundational producer. So FX Pichler's Cuvée M, Gruner Veltliner Smaragd. Smaragd is a word that indicates the highest level of ripeness. So this is Gruner turned up to fucking 15. They usually are bone dry. They land around 14.5 to 15.5% alcohol, massive textural white wines that have just a huge amount of flavor. They usually have some amount of botrytis influence. So they've got that kind of like saffron honeysuckle thing going on. FX Pichler is an audacious producer. M stands for monumental because that's how they feel about this wine, which obviously is attractive to me. I love that kind of attitude.
FX Pichler, monumental, Gruner, Smaragd.
Smaragd.
Smaragd. I believe that is actually from the appellation in Mordor where orc wines are grown.
Yeah,
Smaragd.
Smaragd actually refers to an emerald fence lizard that is native to this area. I don't know why they chose that as the emblem for this ripeness level, but I find it kind of charming.
Yeah, I mean, since it clearly, the etymology of the word must come from the black tongue of Mordor.
Yes, correct. Correct. Try any Smaragd Gruner. I mention Cuvée M specifically because I love it. I recognize it's a very expensive bottle.
How expensive?
It's like $75 to $80.
That's too much.
No, it's not.
I'm not spending that much.
That's fine, but it's not too much.
It's too much for me, Jamie. Right. It's too much for me.
It is a delicious bottle of wine, and y'all should drink it if you are inclined to learn more about Grüner Veltliner.
But what if I'm not inclined to learn more about Grüner Veltliner?
You are unfortunately in a position where you're likely to encounter another one because you're doing a podcast with me.
Yeah. Speaking of things on this podcast that I am unfortunately in the position of encountering again in the future, Jamie, why don't you tell everyone what we're fucking drinking alongside one of the greatest movies of all time ever made next week?
Sherry, bitches.
We're drinking sherry again. Jamie is antagonizing me. That is the only reason for this pairing, because I told him that we were ending the miniseries with the goddamn greatest Mad Max fucking Fury Road, 70-year-old George Miller fucking shaming all of the action babies. I don't need to talk about it. It's Mad Max Fury Road. It's the best. And Jamie, I guess this pairing does kind of work because I had a bottle of this already. And spoilers, it tastes like fucking motor oil.
I love this wine. This is the Lustau Oloroso Almathanista series, Pata de Gallina 138, available at wine.com for $30. Lustau is a foundational house in sherry. They're one of the largest producers, but this is a very small production line that they do called Almathanista. It's delicious. It's super yummy, and Scott's wrong.
Oh, my God. All right, everybody. Well, if our two-parter on Tenet and fucking sherry wasn't your speed, then come back for another great action movie paired with other sherry and lots of complaining from me. But at least you can be guaranteed that this time Jamie won't be bitching about the movie the whole time.
That's true. I love Mad Max.
Because it's the best.
It's the best.
Mad Max Fury Road.
Correct.
All right. Well, that's what we're doing next time. Mad Max Fury Road, as of this recording, on the HBO Max. Check it out. Watch it again and again. And if you've seen it before and think you don't need to rewatch it before the podcast, just shut up and just watch it again.
Just watch it again.
Just watch it again.
And everyone, thank you for joining us.
Sherry.
Please drink more sherry. Follow us on the socials at Bigger Bottle Pod. If you have any questions or complaints, email us at biggerbottlepod@gmail.com or DM at oldmanshudson on Instagram. Make sure you rate, review, and follow the show wherever you get your podcasts. Tell your friends about us too.
Tell your friends about the show. This episode of this show. Now I'm just mad because I'm thinking about having to drink sherry and talk about Mad Max. Woosah. This episode was produced and edited by Scott Hudson. That's me. Our social media presence is thanks to Jamie Harrison Rubin. That is him.
Remember, everyone, drink more wine and watch more movies. It's good for you. We promise.
Can I get any of you a drink? I got nothing. We can't use that. Good night, everyone.
Good night.
Enjoy movies. Sorry about the sherry.